You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY, Portland at 91.1 and 107.1 FM, and in Nehalem, Wheeler, Manzanita, and Rockaway Beach at 91.7 FM. Streaming online everywhere at xray.fm. Radio is yours. What is success? What does it mean to be successful? Is it all about money? Or is it all about love, fame, attention? Or is it some secret other thing that we've yet to explore? I'm Brianna Wheeler, and I want to know what success means to the people that I think are successful. Because success can mean so many different things to so many different people. So let's discover a few new ways together. This is Success Stories. Hello, and welcome to Success Stories, a 30-minute radio program and accompanying podcast featuring Portlanders who have found success in unique and inspiring ways and have shifted Portland's economic, creative, and cultural landscape in the process. Today, I'm talking to Tony Jordan, founder and president of the Parking Reform Network, an organization that educates the public about the impact of parking policy on climate change, equity, housing, and traffic. Thank you for joining me today, Tony.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Lovely to see you. Listeners, you might not know, Tony and I did kind of grow up together in San Pedro, California, and then ended up in Portland, Oregon. How cute is that?
Represent San Pedro, you know.
So proud to be a pirate. Yeah.
That's right.
All right, so you've been in Portland for a while. You've been in Portland for, more than 20 years, right? 25, 26 years?
Yeah, 2002.
Yeah. Dang. That's a tenure. And over the course of your tenure, like, parking somehow becomes, like, the big passion of your life? How does this... Tell me where it starts. Where does the passion for parking reform start?
I mean, there's... So it kind of probably starts with... I mean, I was a late driver. I didn't get my license till 19. And growing up as you know, in San Pedro, where you can actually kind of get around, you're in LA, you're kind of stuck. I moved to places where, you know, Portland specifically, because I felt like things weren't as far away. Mm-hmm. We got rid of our car in 2008. We had just had our son, and we were living in Inner Southeast in Lad's Edition, and our car broke. So we tried going without it. And I mentioned that because, you know, for the next couple of years, living without a car, using Zipcar, taking the bus, you start just to see things a little differently. And then in 2010, in July, I read a blog post on a website called Metafilter. And the post was titled The High Cost of Free Parking. And it was about this professor at UCLA named Donald Shoup, who had written a 700-page book. I have it here on my desk next to me at all times, called The High Cost of Free Parking. In which he really just lays bare the, like, a bunch of shocking facts, honestly. Like, this is like a they live moment. You read this book and you're like, I live across the street from a parking lot. And it's like, why was that there? I never thought about it. How much did those parking spaces cost? Never thought about it. You know, just the fact that cities require a certain amount of parking for all sorts of different types of businesses and types of housing. Never thought about it. Never considered the impacts of this or what was going on. And as I read the book, I just was shocked. Shoup asked me one time, what did you think when you read my book? And I said, I felt like I was eating a hamburger and reading The Jungle. Like, I was disgusted. I was really just what the hell? What's going on? So I looked actually at Portland zoning code at the time, and it was pretty good for the rest of the country. We had no parking requirements for buildings on corridors, and we had no parking requirements downtown. And so I kind of like just started doing other stuff. And then in 2012, Division Street happened, right? They started building apartments on Division Street with no parking. I live in Sunnyside. I was actually chair of the Sunnyside neighborhood at the time. And everyone went crazy and the city started saying, oh, we're going to add parking requirements back. We're going to start mandating that if you build apartments, you have to put parking in past a certain level. And I was like, no, I read this book. I'm like, don't do this. This is a bad idea. And I started going to planning commission and city council. And I met these people in town. There's this guy, Doug Klotz, who is like the patron saint of planning nerds in the city. Met Doug. And I realized that there were people who cared about this, but they were not organized. And there weren't enough people who even knew what was going on. I had worked as a union organizer for a number of years. And I was like, I know how to do something about this. So I set up a mailing list and got a bunch of people on it and started getting people to show up at city council, and we lost. They added parking mandate back. But they did this right before the housing crisis, 2013, right? They did something that made it so if you look at development on Division Street, there were a bunch of apartments with not a lot of parking. But then after 2013, if you built 31 apartments, so 30 apartments you could build with no parking, but 31 you had to build 6 parking spaces, which I'm not going to go too into it, but it's a big deal if you're trying to make an architecture, make a building fit. So what you started to see was a bunch of buildings that had exactly 30 apartments in them, similar to what happened with inclusionary zoning, if people are familiar with affordability, right? That capped it at 20. But so we started cutting off 5, 6, 7 apartments, right? Mm-hmm. For no reason other than parking. And then a couple years later, there's a housing crisis, which was brewing in California and spread up here. And at that point, this became an issue that was much more salient. I worked with tenant organizers from Portland Tenants United, and other folks got involved with YIMBY groups, co-founded Portland Neighbors Welcome, and eventually fixed up our parking requirement situation here in Portland, and then wanted to take it, help other people do the same thing. So then I started my organization in 2019, 2020. Yeah, so that's my long story. Short, hopefully.
Okay, so I get it. You moved to Portland. I mean, I feel like my residency in Portland is kind of rooted in the same feeling of like coming from a large, sprawling city where it is an absolute necessity to have a car or like you, it feels like if to ride the bus in LA can sometimes feel like you lost at life. Like it can feel like demoralizing sometimes. Whereas in Portland, the first time I came here, I was like, whoa, we're encouraging this. Oh my gosh, look at how wonderfully this light rail works. Oh my God. Also, there's a light rail. What? Blew my mind. But furthermore was the way that the city was zoned and that it had all of these distinctly walkable neighborhoods, like these pockets of walkable neighbor. And I felt like that was like this perfect method for a city to run. Learning about the work that you were doing seemed to make a lot of sense, because as we're watching Portland grow, we're watching it become like another car city. Barf, gross, hate it. You've got a lot of experience in organization, and we kind of, you touched on it a little bit, but I really want to like dig into how this shakes out into action. Yes, you're organizing, you're putting together a mailing list. I know that that's just scratching the surface of what it really takes to form a nonprofit, to put passion into action. So kind of unpack that a little bit for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's so, yeah, the first thing was just getting people coordinated, right? How do we, that, and that's the mailing list part, but I'm a talker. I like to meet people. I like to share things I'm interested in. So a lot of this was just, I thought that people don't know. Right. That was the main thing. People told me at like, you know, when I first started doing this, people at the city were like, Tony, this is not a good topic. We don't like the city staff don't like going to parking meetings. People are mad about it. It's you know, people aren't going to want to talk to you. And I was like, I don't know. This seems really interesting. Like it's like, and it's funny. Like there's also, like I go around the country and like these parking requirements are really hilarious. Like in Carver, Massachusetts, one parking space for every 8 occupants in a cemetery. What does that even mean? Like, I don't even, yeah, like, and I have a whole comedy spiel on this, but like, they're, so it's absurd and it's really impactful. And I was like, I think that some of this is we're just not telling people the truth plainly. We're not telling them that parking spaces cost tens of thousands of dollars to build. So as I went forward, I started a blog. So before I started Parking Reform Network, I started a local group called what was called PDX Chupistas or Portlanders from Parking Reform. Our website's still up. And I started just covering local topics, right? Like what was going on with the comprehensive plans, with zoning things where people could weigh in, or if there was an ordinance and telling them how to get connected. telling them about, you know, I worked with bike advocacy groups like Bike Loud to help bridge a gap where the bicycle advocates also land use and how we build things is really important. So like, how do you bridge those things together? I started also just making fun of things like Prosper Portland building the big parking garage down by the hotel where they were trying to say it was going to make money, and it's never going to make money.
Right.
It costs like $60 million. It's a money pit giveaway to build the hotel. And I would just call this stuff out. I had a whole thing where I was saying we should name these parking garages after Ted Wheeler. You know, I made a graphic about if Jay Leno lived in Northwest Portland, he could buy enough parking permits just on his own to park his cars all the way along 22nd Avenue, take up every parking space, right? Because there was no limit on parking permits. There was some controversy around how you could get a parking permit in your neighborhood. And I made a graphic showing that none of the city council members, except for Joanne Hardesty, could have passed the bar. It's so hard to get a parking permit in your neighborhood that none of the city council people at the time had enough votes from the general population, because you have to have 50% of the votes of the potential votes come back, and this is still the way it is, and have 50% plus one vote yes. So it's like of the entire, imagine if of all registered voters, you had to get, you know, at least 26% of all registered voters or 25% plus one to vote for you. No one had met that bar, but in order to just do something simple like manage our curbs, that's the level. And so just pointing out these absurdities did a lot of it. And then, you know, just hustle, replying to emails. That's my main superpower, is I just reply to emails all day. Keep throwing the ball back in people's court. Don't be a jerk. And just be passionate about it. And I just find, I think I read about this book and it touched me and it moved me to action. And so my kind of approach is there's other people like me.
Right.
And as long as I'm putting good energy and the concepts out there, they will come find me. And so far they have, right? You know,
very water finds its own level. Very, your people will find you.
Yeah.
To that end, you went from just Tony being Tony, just getting out there, making your speeches, making your spiel, making your connections. Now the network has there's almost a 30-person team established now, maybe more.
I mean, paid staff, not that many, right? I mean, this is still hard to fund and it's expensive to hire people, but we have a lot. We have a board with,
right.
You know, we have a board, we have advisory board. So we have on our website under About Us, we have, you know, probably somewhat out of date, but a list of people who work with us. We have a lot of collaborators, volunteers, interns, et cetera. So, I mean, the network, you know, membership is hard to quantify because it's not super strict, but, you know, there are, you know, more than 700 people who donate to us every year.
Wow.
We have 700 between, I mean, yeah, I don't know the exact number, but, you know, a growing number of folks that donate. We have a lot of people. We don't have necessarily chapters, but we have partner organizations that we work with across the country. You know, dozens and dozens of partner organizations across the country that we convene to help them. I'm not a carpetbagger on this front. I don't go parachute into some city and say, hey, I'm gonna start a agitation campaign to change your policies. Someone in that city comes to me and says, hey, you know, I saw this map that you made, or I heard a podcast, I read a book by, you know, Henry Grabar's Pay Paradise or something. What do we do? And then we help them to you know, work on the messaging and take the action. So, I mean, the number of people who are working on this is large, but part of the idea is, you know, you can never hire enough staff to fund a national movement on this. I don't think, or why would you even want to? You can help other people take the action, and it's a lot more legitimate and it's a lot, you know, cheaper. And it also, as an aside, I think that helping people develop organizing skills and make positive change and build coalitions has an overall positive impact on our society, right? We're modeling how to do things in a better way, which I think is important nowadays.
yeah, I think so too. So you're talking about there's the HQ that's kind of been built out, But there's also kind of this sprawling network across the country of people that are reaching out. There's a lot of back and forth here. Now, aside from city governments, what are some key partnerships that are enabling you, the team, to like facilitate? Because you are seeing changes happen on a more, it's not just happening in Portland. You're out in these streets, right? So what are some of the partnerships that are crucial to that?
I mean, like, I mentioned YIMBYs up front, right? Like, I was at the first, I went to the first YIMBY conference, which was in Boulder 2016.
Oh, tell us what YIMBY means, first of all, for the uninitiated.
So it's kind of like, you know, it was an opposition to no, not in my backyard, to NIMBYs, right? And this was a movement that kind of started in the Bay Area because of the housing crisis there. And it was focused on changing the zoning rules to allow for more housing. And they're very focused on that. And I know a lot of folks in that movement, and it was a natural position to push these reforms, right? The cost of parking and the space parking takes up makes it difficult to build housing, especially lower income housing or more affordable housing in walkable areas. It's very difficult to do if you're requiring 1.5 to 2 parking spaces per apartment, which is the average across the country. So worked with them. That's a huge network, and now that movement has grown up similar to, like, you know, has a wide, there's YIMBY organizations all over the country. So we work with them, work with transportation orgs. We work with, you know, folks, AARP is a big supporter of this type of policy. We don't have a formal relationship with them, but they've supported a lot of these zoning reforms. More recently, it's become pretty exciting. There was a big win in North Carolina last week, or within the last 2 weeks. I mean, we've celebrated every passage, you know, when it passed the Senate, when it passed the House, you know, but the North Carolina, which is a Republican legislature, Democrat governor, so purple state, you know, passed a law that basically eliminates parking requirements in 90% of the state, both commercial, so for businesses, and for residential. And the thing about this bill, which is the most comprehensive one to date, is that it was proposed by the Catawba Riverkeeper, right? By a water conservation, well, river conservation organization. And their approach to this was, you know, when you require all these surface parking lots to be built, which is what the parking mandates basically do. If you think about anything built after 1970 that's a commercial center, looks like a giant parking lot.
Yeah.
Every time it rains, a ton of nasty water, urban stew is a good word for it, pours off of there and pollutes your rivers. Yeah. Unless you spend, like, I always like to say, in Portland, we don't have a subway tunnel, but we do have a sewer subway that we built that cost $2 billion, right? The big pipe that we love to watch fill up when it rains. Well, that's all water that's just coming off parking lots in, you know, at Mall 205, right? I mean, like, it's like, we didn't have to build all those parking lots, but we certainly didn't have to require them. And now we're paying billions of dollars to mitigate the impact. So this stuff pollutes water. So these river keepers said, hey, if we don't require the parking to be built, it doesn't immediately solve the problem, but it at least stops making it worse.
Right.
Can we stop making it worse? And the, you know, conservative folks there and liberal folks, is bipartisan, got together and said, that's good. There's also a big economic development aspect, right? Businesses. There's an example, like, just this, there was this guy, Val, who had a cheesecake shop in Dallas. This is just a great story that I saw. Oh, a terrible story, but he had a to-go cheesecake shop, and he wanted to provide cheesecake in his store. Like, you can buy a slice. Changing from a takeout restaurant to one with seating was going to require him to have like 4 more parking spaces, and he didn't have room for it. You have a shop, you can't just add 4 parking spaces. So he could never expand his business that way. And in fact, he wasn't even allowed to participate in the street fair on his street because he wasn't a restaurant. So then he had to fence off his business during the street fair. Business closed, right? Failed, right? Because of these, partly because of these requirements. So when you tell people this, they're like, even, you know, I mean, I shouldn't say even, like, people who care actually about small business entrepreneurship, you know, conservative, liberal alike, it's like, this is not what was intended,
right?
We're not solving a problem with these rules anymore. There's better ways to solve that, to solve the problem of people parking on a street. Charge them money, honestly, it's the best. And use the money for good stuff, sidewalks, lighting, you know, crosswalks. That's what you should do instead. So there's been huge success from a growing coalition on this topic. And I think it's only, you know, there's enough work to do for 1,000 years. Hopefully not. But I mean, really, you know, once we even get rid of these mandates, getting cities to actually price their curbs properly, even here in Portland, we don't do it by the book how we should. And so there's a lot more work there, too.
Right. I see, like, in a big picture sense, I see that. So a big impetus is to, like, remove the parking mandates. But then what? Like, in a imagined perfect future that sees us kind of move away from prioritizing parking, prioritizing car transportation, what, like, is there, like, a utopian kind of ultimate result that is, like, a car-free city? I mean, is that, like, what is the ultimate?
I mean, I don't know if that's, I mean, I like to, I'm not trying to social engineer anyone's life. I'm not trying to tell anyone they can't drive. I don't like to drive, but I'm not telling people they can't. People who have a parking space at their house that they pay for and like to drive to the mall can do that. That's going to be a while before that goes away.
Right.
You mentioned right up front, Portland with its neighborhoods. And you said, you know, we were zoned that. We weren't zoned that way. That was organic growth, right? The reason we have Hawthorne, Mississippi, Division, well, now Division, you know, Belmont, you know, all these corridor streets is because they were built without these rules, right?
Right.
Anything built after like 1960, we decided to freeze. And you look at like Hawthorne, and that's a great street, but there should be a lot more there, right? You see a small storefront. That storefront was not meant to be like that forever. The natural order of cities we saw for 100 years or so or more was you built something and then you built up, right? You intensified the use and you had these. So what part of this is just allowing us to build to meet the demand for walkable places, for
right.
places with density, for places where people can live near their kids or near their job or near their school. And so there's a lot of work to still do. I often will say getting rid of these requirements and zoning in general, like adjusting your zoning is kind of like getting the rocks and the grass out of your lawn. If you want to start a garden, you can't just do that and then walk away. Nothing's going to grow right. there, right? There is still a lot of work to be done. That's not my work to finish of, you know, finding the investment of, you know, of doing other, providing the transit, you know, to accommodate this. If you remove these rules, a lot of developers, a lot of builders are still going to build parking. We see that.
Right.
Sometimes they build a lot because they want to rent their apartments and they know they're not going to be able to rent the apartment if they can't get there.
Right.
So you actually have to do a lot more. This at least says we're not going to stop you from doing it, right? We're going to allow it. Right now, the only places that are built like this generally are these like little model communities, and they're very expensive, right? They're mm-hmm. exclusive. They're brand new. They're bougie, you know, and it's like, no, this should be for the people, right? You should allow someone with an idea of how they want their neighborhood to be to open a store to cut hair. And so there's a whole lot of like, you know, there's a lot of other policies we can do around, you know, we see missing middle housing. There's ideas around allowing more neighborhood commercial businesses mm-hmm. or accessory commercial, like allowing someone to cut hair in their basement like my grandmother did in the 60s,
sure.
or, you know, have a coffee shop in their garage. Like, you know, like if you have these things, you actually, we don't need to get everyone to Mississippi or to Hawthorne or to downtown St. John, right? There should be places where people are, you know, like able to go in their neighborhood. And that I think is, to me, one of the dreams is, you know, just a kid can go buy toys or candy without their parents driving them somewhere, right? You know, mm-hmm. or a elderly person in the neighborhood can go get lunch and buy a newspaper without having to, you know, like get on a bus or in a car. I love buses. I love transit, but I also prefer just to walk. I prefer to ride my bike.
Right.
I think, you know, that's it's nice to be able to do at least some of your trips like that. And we can solve a lot of problems by making that possible again.
For sure. I'm right there with you. I don't mind driving. I like that is an option, but if given the choice, I'm walking or I am riding my bike. That's yeah. what I want to do. And it's really kind of like a big reason why I moved here. The first time I came to Portland, I saw it was just dumping rain. And it was the evening of our first night here. And I saw a mother and her daughter on their bikes together in the rain. And I thought, oh my God, I would never see this in Los Angeles. I would never, ever. But they were like, no, this is, we're grocery shopping in this weather and we're doing it on bikes. Woo, but still right. My beating heart. I knew that this was the place for me, like right off the bat. So I did a workshop with some kids this week, a zine making workshop with like some teenagers and that were doing a summer program. And I had been hearing that the kids have not been all right. That is like the narrative that is permeating the airwaves right now. The kids are not all right. But I want to, I would argue that. I had a lot of conversations with these kids between 15 and 18 years old. And a lot of them saw themselves moving into careers in nonprofit. And they had very clear ideas of the nonprofit type of work that they wanted to do. And it made me think of you. And I wondered what kind of advice you would give to them. Like, what are the, okay, pun intended, what are the roadblocks, the biggest roadblocks that have, that you've encountered through the network's formation and growth?
I mean, the big one is, you know, is getting paid. To be honest, like, you know, most people in my position are able to take the leap and do this because they have a windfall, right? Someone dies. Someone, you know, you know, something happens to you where you are able to follow your dream, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, and potentially at great risk. I mean, you know, it's not like, you know, if you quit your job and work for free for a few years, that's not a good financial strategy, you know? So I think like that is a thing. It's hard to get people to believe in you, especially, I mean, my flippant advice would be make sure you do a nonprofit that people understand, you know, like, I'm like, if I ever did this again, I'm going to do something with children or puppies, you know, like where it's like, what do you do? Oh, I save puppies. Like, that's like an easy way. People will just open their wallets and their hearts to you. What do you do? Oh, well, have you ever considered the high cost of free parking? Like, it's a really much harder approach. So like, I would say, you know, that's one thing is to pick something that if you have the opportunity is, more accessible, really have a plan of how you're going to end up getting paid. You know, invest in yourself in learning, leadership, things like how to manage people, how to make sure your filings are done. A lot of nonprofits fall apart. And also, you know, take your time. You know, you don't have to go do everything on your own. I mean, like I if there had been another organization, initially, I tried to approach other organizations that already existed and ask them, do you want to host this project? Do you want to do something with me? And they didn't. They were like, there's no money in it. Like, we don't know how to get it funded. And so, but I think in a lot of other areas where people want to work, find someone and work with someone, you know, work with someone who's already doing the work. This was a rare case where there was some academics doing this, but there was no other alternate parking reform network. There's an organization called Strong Towns that was kind of working on this policy, but it wasn't even their primary focus. And it was not the same kind of advocacy approach. So I was really in a place where I had to do the thing that I wanted to see. But I think in many cases, you probably can find someone to pair up with, find someone to work with, and not have to reinvent the wheel on your own. That would be, I think, another piece of advice is, you know, make sure, do your diligence and make sure there's not someone you can work with already. It's going to make your life a lot easier and more stable.
Right. Yeah, that's like a key piece of this puzzle is that like the community has to be, or there has to be some manner of community on board, like some type of partnership group, some kind of support system in place.
Yeah. As much as it's grown, it's still a tremendously niche issue.
Big thanks to this week's guest, Mr. Tony Jordan. Learn more about the Parking Reform Network at parkingreform.org. Don't forget to follow Success Stories on socials at successstoriespdx. And learn more about me at briannawheeler.com. All right, I'll talk at you next week. Until then, do remember that success is what we make it.